supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Eating disorders. So many factors contribute to why people develop these very severe disorders. There's media as one factor. There's genetics. There's family structure. The constant social pressure to be thin, to be perfect. And as the pressure continues to intensify, well, research and treatment also, fortunately, intensify. So today we're here to discuss the latest eating disorder research and treatment. We've been doing this for 30, 40 years now. Let's find out what we've learned, what's different, and what's the same. We're joined by Dr. Jane Shore and Dr. Michael Lowe, both psychologists. Jane Shore is the co-editor of Effective Clinical Practice in the Treatment of Eating Disorders, the heart of the matter. Michael Lowe's professor of psychology at Drexel University, who's researching eating disorders. He did an exhaustive study at Renfrew. We'll hear a little bit about that. And we'll also hear one woman's story about her battle with an eating disorder. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have had an eating disorder, a loved one has, give us a call. That's 888-477-9499. Jane, let's start with you. You really were one of the pioneers. You've been doing this for 30 years since you were about 7 years old. So let's start with the appearance of eating disorders 30 years ago. Did the people who walked into your office look similar to the way they do now, say similar things?
Well, there's many more people today that come in with eating disorders because there's been an epidemic of eating disorders. That's quite different from where we were 30 years ago. We were just beginning to learn something about eating disorders 30 years ago, and those of us who are authors in this book that you mentioned came together really to be able to share what we were experiencing in the treatment room and what we were learning as we were doing it, not really knowing what we were doing because no one ever taught us about eating disorders or the treatment of eating disorders.
So we're going to talk during the show about how treatment has evolved, but the illness itself, other than numbers, seems about the same as it did 30 years ago?
No, I think the illness is quite different. That's reflecting the culture that we live in. Before we had a digital technology that allowed images to get manipulated, as is so prevalent today and as has been prevalent for about the last 20 years, there is an expectation that you see being influencing children at an earlier and earlier stage, and parents as well, that one should be able to look at these ultra-thin images. You see actresses on the screen that are ultra-thin, that are obsessed with having to stay on diets and work out at extreme levels. That didn't exist in the 70s and even in the 80s.
Michael, I'm going to ask you a question. It's probably impossible to summarize. But certainly our understanding of eating disorders has evolved over the last 30 years.
Well, and by understanding, I would say absolutely that's the case. I would divide the idea of understanding into sort of two ways of understanding or two ways of sort of knowing about eating disorders, and that's the primarily clinical approach, which practitioners, live this every day and have to figure out the best way of treating these and other patients. The other way of knowing is an empirical perspective, which is based on research.
So what have we learned? Like I said, it's impossible to summarize. There's volumes
yes.
written. But what did we know then and what do we know now?
Okay. Well, one thing that's important to clarify is that some form of eating disorders appear to have been with us for centuries. They used to be known in other guises, often very religiously associated. But actually, while anorexic-like disorders have been with us for a long time, bulimia nervosa, which involves some weight loss but not the emaciation that goes on in anorexia, is actually a new, quote, new disorder. And when you talk about 30 years ago, it actually was exactly 30 years ago this year that bulimia nervosa was first described in the literature. So something new has been added to anorexia nervosa.
Which raises lots of questions about, gets back to the culture, the family, so on and so forth, because genetics don't evolve that quickly. Eating disorders are difficult to understand because, in a way, they seem self-inflicted. From the outside, it looks like a perfectly healthy person is ruining their lives and body, and it would all end if they just decided to eat. I mean, on the outside, it sounds pretty simple. It's hard to imagine the torture and suffering that goes on inside of the person. Mike and Scott spoke with Sharon, a Philadelphia woman who, she's in her mid-40s, she suffered with an eating disorder for years until she finally sought treatment at Belmont Treatment Center. Mike and asked her when the disorder really started. I guess we don't have that clip available to us now, but one of the things Sharon said was that this disorder started she first had symptoms when she was an adult, and we're hearing more about that. You know, the research shows the prevalence of eating disorders is between 18 and 30, but we're hearing more adults. Oh, we do have that piece now, so I can stop blathering. All right, so let's listen to that piece from Mike.
I think that I always had some different kind of ideas about eating, even though I didn't per se have an eating disorder. But I think my main eating disorder happened later on in my life, like after maybe in my 30s when my more serious eating behaviors started. A lot of them were brought on, I think, by being maybe a little upset about how my life was going, my career or my job not working the way I thought. And I don't know why or how things started, but not eating and just eating at night one meal would be a way to just get through everything I had to in a day.
How old were your kids when this?
When it became more serious, my kids were in high school, and I really had not a very pleasant relationship with them because I was so involved in my eating disorder and didn't really focus on their needs as much as I should. I mean, I took care of their basic needs of food, shelter, and whatnot, but more I was in my own world with my eating disorder and didn't really relate to them like I should.
Was this ever about body image, that you wanted to be thin, or was it really more about controlling what else was going on in your life?
Yeah, I always was into athletics, so I was really more obsessive with exercise at one point. So I didn't really have the body image per se. I just liked to exercise, but it became an obsession. That became over-exercise. But I think I also loved to control. I liked controlling things, and I had a lot of obsessive compulsive behaviors that I liked because I would control different things with them.
Can you give me an example of some of the behaviors, the mm-hmm. obsessive behaviors?
Some of the obsessive behaviors that I dealt with were writing notes obsessively. I had bags of pieces of paper that were illegible to anything. I would scribble down things, random things I heard, this, that, or the other, everything I could think of, just writing it down And that became a way just to control what was around me. So I would write down things, but kind of scribble it down so you couldn't, you know, understand it. And I also would write down what I was going to eat that day and when I was going to eat it. There came a point where I just felt like I could not eat before my kids went to sleep and before the news was on. That became a ritual also in itself. That was another obsession, to keep the schedule and to keep exactly what I ate the same at the same time. The whole day revolved around just exercising, thinking about what I was going to eat, finally eating, then going to sleep.
And what did you eat?
My famous bowl of cream of wheat with just a little jelly and a little margarine. Had a little piece of toast with that.
Did your kids ever say, "Mom, eat with us"?
Yes, yeah. And I still to this day have a lot of feelings about how many functions I missed, events, no restaurants, of course, ever, and then no family functions because that would mostly revolve around food. So it would be mostly isolation. I never went anywhere. I stayed at home, walked the dogs, did my exercise, and I would make my kids food, but then I felt that I had to exercise because I was around the food. I had a bizarre, I don't know, belief that I would gain the calories from being around other food that I didn't consume. So that also meant, believe it or not, now that I think about it, it doesn't, of course, make any rational sense, but we lived across from Wawa. So when I would walk the dogs, I would always have to pass Wawa, and of course people coming out with food and this and that and whatnot. So that meant every time I would go back home, I would have to exercise more to get off the calories I thought that I gained by smelling the foods.
At the time,
mm-hmm.
did it feel out of control? Did you know that this wasn't right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Rationally, I mean, I am educated, and I feel like I know how to think about things rationally, so I didn't like that it was out of control. And then finally, it was the last straw when one night my son came home, and he had gone out with my dad, and he had eaten a hamburger at Chili's restaurant. I'll never forget this. And I would never go near, meat, let alone other food, but forget meat because I was a vegetarian. And, you know, he had wanted some comfort. He had had a horrible day at school. I'll never forget this night. And I wouldn't kiss him. I wouldn't give him a hug. So that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Then I knew that if I couldn't even relate to my kids, something was way wrong. I was ignoring my kids most of the time because of my eating disorder, but this was too much that I couldn't even hug them, you know. So that's the next day is when I called Belmont and went in. The next day, actually, the next morning.
Mike and Scott spoke with Sharon, a Philadelphia woman in her 40s who suffered from an eating disorder. Sharon completed treatment, by the way, at Belmont Treatment Center and has since been in recovery. She reports that her relationship with her children has improved, and she says she finally feels like she is part of the world again. That's an incredible story. Jane, let me turn to you. You know, the introduction of that clip is that it's hard for people to understand what goes on, not just what goes on, but how it happens. Here's a woman who was educated, who convinced herself that she was getting calories from seeing food, smelling food at Wawa. How does that happen in the brain? Help us understand that.
Well, it's a great question, and she did a great job of articulating what it's like to live under a severe eating disorder. What happens is that initially somebody attempts to feel better about themselves. They're not having an easy time coping with whatever stressors are going on in their life. They're generally not able to really understand their emotions and their inner talk. And so they turn to dieting behavior and manipulating food and counting calories. And initially, it's very rewarding because they're able to have a sense, as she said, of being in control and changing something about self. But what happens over time is that that good feeling transforms into a tyrannical inner force within the mind that has an extreme critic that's running the show. And the critic becomes a taskmaster, creating these rules and regulations that have to be rigidly followed. And if somebody follows it, they have that sense of being good and being in control. But if they break the rules or defy the rules, they have a sense of being bad and weak, and they're attacked.
One, I want to capture a phrase you used about emotions, and you said they're not able to feel emotions or understand emotions.
They're not able to understand their emotions.
Okay.
They don't have a way of tuning in.
Where do people learn to not understand their emotions? We're born with that skill.
Well, we're born with the skill of feeling our emotions, but we learn to understand our emotions by what we in the world of psychology called attunement, by parents and caretakers tuning into the cues that we are sending out, and by their language. So when parents speak to children in language that help them understand that they're upset about something, or they're really confused about something, or something's really itchy and they're uncomfortable, then children develop language to be able to explain to themselves what's going on.
All right, so make it a little bit less theoretical. I'm a parent, and I want to make sure I'm doing this right for my child to help.
So I'm going to talk to you about what I notice you feeling. Rather than be quiet about that, I'm going to give you language. So I'm going to say things like, oh, you're really chilly right now. Let me give you something to warm your body. Because chilly is a sensation in the body, and all our feelings are felt in the body also. Oh, you look like you're really upset about that. What's going on for you? Tell me about how you're feeling right now. And where a lot of parents miss the boat is that they dismiss the feelings. They tell a child, oh, don't worry about that. You don't need to be concerned about that. And they then quiet and shut down the voice that the child is developing to be able to articulate that emotional self.
And my experience in the clinical office is that these children wind up being ashamed of having feelings altogether and or deny them. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mel on the line. Mel, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi. I have a 13-year-old who's had anorexia for 2 years, and I feel kind of frustrated about some of the therapy experiences that we've had. Maudsley was suggested for us, which is when you're very, very involved in food and refeeding and being very hands-on. And then my daughter went into a different hospital, and then they said, no, hands-off completely. Don't get involved in her food. She's responsible. She needs to plan it. Also, having a 13-year-old, I wonder if someone could talk about where you find programs for young kids. And also, having had this for 2 years, if someone could address where you can find ongoing research.
Well, you've just about covered my interview here. So, all right, I'm going to ask you to take your multiple answers off the air, and we'll tackle them. First of all, let's talk about research, Michael, with eating disorders with 13-year-olds. Here's a woman getting mixed messages. What's right?
Okay, I can empathize with her situation because, especially as a consumer, there is a world full of apparent experts touting many, many different perspectives based on many, many different foundations. And it's very easy to feel overwhelmed and confused because everyone sounds like they have the answer.
So what's right?
Yes.
So what are we learning?
Well, from my perspective, the field is and has for decades been going about things somewhat backwards. So what I mean by that is that there is a very big productive research field out there, and there are thousands of clinicians doing this work.
So what can we tell Mel?
What we can tell Mel is that she should is quite well advised to be seeking what the latest research is suggesting. It's not easy to do that on her own.
What is it suggesting? Is it hands-on? Is it hands-off?
What it's suggesting is, for instance, for the Maudsley approach, particularly with children, adolescents and children, that has been shown through research studies to be relatively effective for anorexia.
Which is what?
What is Maudsley?
Mm-hmm.
Maudsley, as she said, is a very hands-on eating focused, especially in its earliest stages. It evolves, okay? But Maudsley takes the perspective that the first and most important task is to get the child back into a healthy nutritional state, and then whatever other issues may have helped induce the eating disorder can then be treated more effectively.
Okay, so let me turn to you, Jane. Here she gets just the opposite feedback at another hospital, and I can see the rationale in that too, because it's a control struggle, and she's got to take responsibility for her life and don't focus on food because that's not the issue. So,
well, with a 13-year-old, there's going to be, you know, all sorts of different possibilities of how to approach treatment. What I think is important for this mother to know is that she needs to be the advocate for this child, that it will be her job to keep researching and checking out, and that there is no one method that fits all. When a 13-year-old has been struggling with symptoms of an eating disorder that are entrenched in this way, there is clearly an obsessive compulsive base to her nervous system. And that really has to get worked with in multiple ways, because right now what she's done is she's been using food and all the rituals of restriction to try to manage her anxiety and sense of being terrified.
You both mentioned that she has to do some research. Any websites you can recommend before we take our break or resource lists?
I would suggest that she go to NIH.gov and then go to the NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health website, where, of course, NIH is research-based, and that would be one great source to find that.
Okay. Jane?
And I would recommend the achancetoheal.org website and the NEDA website, NEDA.
Okay. And there's also Eating Disorders Association, too, websites. Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back. We've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation, and I do want to talk about treatment and get more specific with it. We're talking about eating disorders today on today's show, and our phone number is 888-477-9499. We've got one open line left, and I want to say to the callers, we'll try our best to get to you. My guests are Dr. Jane Shore and Michael Lowe. Shore is co-editor of Effective Clinical Practice in the Treatment of Eating Disorders, the Heart of the Matter. She's also in private practice here in the Philadelphia area. Lowe's a professor of psychology at Drexel, who's researching eating disorders and has done so for a couple of decades himself. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital joins you in supporting WHYY. Jefferson Hospital for Neuroscience is dedicated to the care and treatment of patients with aneurysms, acute strokes, AVMs, and brain tumors. Employing the latest in non-invasive technologies, including endovascular coiling, interventional stroke therapies, gamma knife, and shaped beam surgery. To schedule an appointment or for information, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
In 1989, members from the Chapel Hill, North Carolina pop-punk band Superchunk started their own record label to release singles and cassettes for themselves and the Friends bands.
2 decades later, Merge Records has mushroomed into an iconic indie label from bands like Neutral Milk Hotel, Arcade Fire, Spoon, and many others.
This week on Sound Opinions, we explore the 20-year history of Merge Records with Merge co-founders Laura Balance and Mac McCaughan.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about eating disorders with Dr. Michael Lowe and Dr. Jane Shore. Jane is a clinician who is a co-editor of Effective Clinical Practice in the Treatment of Eating Disorders. Michael Lowe's professor of psychology at Drexel University. When we heard from Sharon earlier in the show, her eating disorder really started apparently in adulthood. So is that common? Is that unusual, Michael?
It was once quite unusual. It has becoming more common for reasons that we're not sure of. I would emphasize that she mentioned two things that might be significant even before a serious eating disorder developed. One was she said that she had for a long time had, quote, different ideas about eating, and I'd want to know more about what that means. And secondly, she said that she was an athlete and apparently exercised quite a bit, and those may be some early signs, especially the obsessive exercise, of problems coming.
There's also, I mean, we know, you know, Jane, these subclinical eating disorders, how many people restrict, count calories ad absurdum. I've got one friend of mine who also eats one meal a day or won't go near anything that has any fat in it. And, you know, she's fine. She functions fine. It doesn't dominate her life, but...
Well, one of the things we think about so often is looking at the symptoms of the eating disorder, but there's the behind the symptoms that is the precursor to the development of an eating disorder, and that's what's going on in the mind and in the self-talk process for a person. So somebody could appear perfectly fine on the outside and think of themselves as perfectly fine well through adolescence and even college life when life is pretty structured, and then get out there into the real world and they'll have the real stressors of life that are quite different and be subjected to their highly critical, negative, anxious mind. And then the rituals of controlling food and controlling, focusing on things that allow you to distract away from yourself become very appetizing, if you'd say.
You compared this eating disorders to an autoimmune disease.
Yes.
How so?
Well, an autoimmune disease is a situation where the body turns against itself, and with an eating disorder, the self turns against itself. The ability for the self to thrive and sustain itself and to do those things of thought and emotion and behavior that help us flourish get compromised, and we instead restrict, we constrict, we get afraid, and we do the extreme of isolating, as Sharon talked about.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Gabrielle on the line. Gabrielle?
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I have struggled and recovered from an eating disorder and have since been working on awareness and promoting funding for it. The problem I have encountered is in promoting awareness, you are also displaying the behaviors. I know that I personally started my eating disorder behaviors in middle school when I learned about them in health class. So I'm it's kind of a contradiction, and I'm debating what to discuss when you're promoting awareness.
That's really an interesting question. I see both Both of my guests are having a reaction. Michael?
Okay. You're quite right that women, young girls who are predisposed toward an eating disorder are very sensitive to this kind of information, and when they hear it, they can misuse it. But I think the answer to that is not to restrict the amount of good information out there, but is to provide the warnings of how this information can be misused even as you're trying to provide that education.
Hmm. Jane?
Well, I think that we have to teach people about how to develop resilience skills and self-esteem, that we assume self-esteem just happens in the course of natural development, and it actually doesn't. It is something that we actively do. So in teaching children, middle school in particular, and high schoolers, if we teach about how we actually do build self-esteem, then we're going to give them a roadmap. And we give them a roadmap by telling about how the mind produces negative thoughts automatically, and that there are things that we can do to pay attention to that and to counter that. And we can teach them about the ways that our thoughts distort beliefs and also affect our feelings about ourselves and about how other people are perceiving us. When people are given real information, they're empowered. And next month is going to be published a self-esteem curriculum that I've been working on for the last 5 years called the Inside Outside Self-Discovery Program that was based on years and years of working with kids to help train them to be able to counter the natural course of stressors.
And not being an expert, I would add one other thing, and because I'm not an expert, take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, when Jane used the word empowering, I would think it would empower you or give you credibility when you introduce eating disorders to these kids or to wherever you're doing it. Tell the whole story, the good news and the bad news. And the good news is, you know, you have the feeling of being in control and you get compliments on your body and it feels good, and then talk about the bad news because, you know, you tell the whole story, so if somebody starts to slip down that road, they'll know what's going on with their minds.
I think it's important to point out a couple of things here at the same time. One is we have to remember that eating disorders are overall quite rare, that the prevalence of anorexia is 1% of women. The prevalence of diagnosed bulimia is 2%. You can probably double those figures for people who have serious problems but don't meet the diagnosis, but we're still talking about 5-6%. And therefore, I think it's awfully important to not treat all women about the same in terms of their risk and self-esteem and so on, and focus on why such a small percentage have such serious predisposition for this.
That's a good point. Let's go back to the to the phones. We've got Kathy on the line. Kathy?
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for having this broadcast. In speaking to people's self-esteem and self-perception, when I went through this with my daughter, I did not understand what I was seeing. And incidents happened. For example, I came into the bathroom once when she was in fifth grade. She was in the shower, and I could see through the curtain she was not undressed. I found her showering in her bathing suit and thought it was just utter silliness. And I reprimanded her in that way, like, what's the matter with you, you crazy kid? Retrospectively, I understand now that she was so uncomfortable with her own body that she didn't want to see it, even in the shower. So, and that's the kind of thing that, talking about your inner voice, that's, I guess, the biggest part of therapy is bringing that inner voice out so someone else can help you untangle it.
Yeah, and how that is done is a pretty complicated issue. Kathy, I thank you for calling. You and I met this morning online. I got your email, so that's how we got you on the show. Thanks so much for calling, and I do wish you the best. So that inner critic to get it on the outside is easier said than done, huh, Jane?
The inner critic is much easier said than done. But combining both of these last couple of callers, I think it's really important to think about educating people about how we are living in a culture that bombards us with messages from the media to make us feel bad about ourselves. And that while we may think we are not under the influence of that, the statistics are astounding, suggesting that we're all subjected to 3,000 advertisements a day. And these people are making a lot of money by hooking us on feeling bad about ourselves so that we'll spend our money to buy their products. And middle school and high school kids need to be trained to look at these things, to look at advertisements, to understand that. And they get excited by that. And in particular, they need to understand about dieting behavior, because the dieting industry spends billions of dollars trying to hook people into the process of dieting, even though, again, the statistics are astounding that only 5% of people who diet maintain their weight loss within 2 years. So the inner critic is something that we have to explain all the ways in which family helps us to develop a harsh, critical inner voice, and also the culture does, because it's being encouraged rather than discouraged each day we live.
I would just like to add something here, in that I'm a little concerned that the listeners are not getting kind of a complete picture of the source of information and evidence that is out there. And it's important to emphasize this, because when you talk about developing or deciding on what kind of therapy someone should seek and what is wrong with eating disordered individuals, there's a whole world of researchers and scientists out there who have been studying these problems and published thousands of papers that have told us an awful lot about where eating disorders come from, and in fact that there are certain treatments that are more effective than other treatments.
And what are they?
The most effective treatment for bulimia nervosa is cognitive behavior therapy, which has been shown in about 24 studies. And those studies have compared cognitive behavior therapy, which is manualized and is very clear. Any therapist could learn how to do it with the appropriate training. It has compared cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT, with many of the treatments that we're talking about here today, and has been found to be superior in trial after trial. And that doesn't mean that something like the cognitive behavior therapy approach is sufficient for all patients. It isn't. You have to build all treatment on a very trusting, meaningful, and close relationship. That's the first step in any therapy. But I'm afraid we are talking as if there isn't a very elaborate, sophisticated science of the treatment of eating disorders, when in fact it exists.
So let's take the next step. You mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy for bulimia. What about anorexia?
It has also been used with anorexia, and so far it, like all other psychotherapies that have been tried, have been found to be inadequate. That's across the board. But it's important to know that too, empirically, because that suggests, hey, we have to start keep learning more about what is underlying anorexia, because all the treatments we've tried so far, including pharmacotherapy or drug therapy, have not worked very well.
Jane?
Well, as you said, the heart of the matter is the therapeutic relationship. And with anorexia, we see the deficits in being able to attend to one's own emotional and physiological sense of regulation. And while there's been a plethora of information about why eating disorders develop and various cognitive ideas about it, what hasn't been prevalent is the art of the psychotherapy. It takes a lot of very active work to do this therapy. It's more active work than in any other psychotherapy I've ever done. And it involves a lot of psychoed, a lot of conveying to the person what you understand about what's going on in their mind and how it's running them. And it involves a process that essentially is helping to reprogram their mind.
First of all, I would completely agree that there is a lot of art involved in psychotherapy. And part of the reason is because it's based very much on a relationship. But there is also now, unlike 30 years ago, a very substantial science of psychotherapy and of eating disorders treatment in particular. And the argument that I and many of my colleagues are increasingly making is that if this scientific evidence exists, that it doesn't mean it's the final answer, a magic pill, but it does suggest that just as in medicine, we expect when we go to see our doctor, we don't expect to be treated by the art of medicine, but because today there is a very substantial science of medicine and drug therapy and so on, we expect our physician to know that research and apply it to us. There's enough science now underlying psychotherapy for eating disorders that my view is that it's the responsibility of therapists to start there and with the relationship and build on that.
I hear your frustration as a researcher, and I can only imagine that. I'll tell you, though, as a frequent consumer of medicine, I want a doctor who's skilled at both the art and the science, and if I can't find that, I'm going to find another doctor. I really want both, or else I'm not going to feel safe.
But if you're a psychotherapy patient, one of the things that we really haven't talked about here very much at all is that if, and it's very important to emphasize if, because this doesn't exist in all fields of psychopathology, it so happens that eating disorders is one where the research evidence has been substantial and has been clear-cut in its implications. And to talk about just the art of psychotherapy without mentioning the clear evidence for approach that does work better than the other approaches that have been tried, I think is just too narrow for the listening audience.
Let me ask you one small concrete question before we take our break. We're really running late. If you are seeking cognitive behavioral therapy for a child who's got bulimia, would you want to seek someone who practices that, or do you want to seek someone who specializes in eating disorder and is knowledgeable about that?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, the ideal combination is someone who knows cognitive behavior therapy and has a long history of treating eating disorders. If I had to go with one or the other, I would go with the person who's expert in CBT, even though they don't have a long history of.
Well, it's a powerful statement.
Yeah. I would disagree, actually.
I know
and you knew that was going to come.
Your book is.
I think that most very good therapists have a base of understanding CBT because it is so much the foundation of therapeutic training.
But being able to engage. We haven't talked about that at all today until I brought it up. And so I think that says something about the greater therapeutic world out there.
Well,
this is really tricky psychotherapy. You're dealing with life death issues that
we're gonna have to take a break because one thing I promise you and our listeners is that we're not going to resolve this in the
Absolutely.
11 minutes we have left in the show. So we're talking about eating disorders and their treatment and the options for treatment. My guests are Drs. Jane Shore and Michael Lowe. Shore's co-editor of Effective Clinical Practice in the Treatment of Eating Disorders. Lowe's a professor of psychology at Drexel, who's been researching eating disorders for several decades now. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
One Book, One Jewish Community, a project of Jewish Outreach Partnership, supported by Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia, supports WHYY, featuring a family festival celebrating the Jewish experience in Arab lands, with music by Devon, storytelling, crafts, food, and more. Sunday, March 29th, 3 to 5 p.m., open to the public at Congregation Knesseth Israel, Elkins Park, 215-635-2877 or jewishphilly.org/onebook.
Next time on Tell Me More, Asian American fraternities have dramatically increased their presence on college campuses, but unfortunately, so have the complaints about hazing.
Physical injury is almost a normal part of what we go through. It's almost like a gang initiation for college students.
I'm Michelle Martin. We'll go behind closed doors to look at Greek life with an Asian American twist. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about eating disorders with Dr. Michael Lowe and Jane Shore. Michael is a professor of psychology at Drexel University. He's been researching in the field for several decades. Jane Shore is a clinician who's been treating eating disorders for several decades. And let's go right back to the phones. We've got Susan on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, well, it's not even a question, more of a statement. I know there are long-term effects of eating disorders because I have a 36-year-old daughter who had an eating disorder beginning at 8 years old. And she has had nothing but trouble her whole life. Nothing's been... she's kind of been out of control her whole life, even up to this point. So I'm still looking for answers as to how I can help her.
What do you mean by out of control, Susan?
Well, she just got out of prison. She was on drugs for a while. She danced at a gentleman's club for 6 years. She was abused by a husband. She was her personality is very. She protects herself from anybody's control.
Let's see if we get to this. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to get any real answers here, but it does raise questions. Let's see if we can get some at least guidance for Susan, some ideas how to think about it. I mean, she talked about her daughter with an eating disorder, and it raises a question in my mind: is the eating disorder the problem, or is it a symptom of a deeper problem?
I'm hearing a description of a much more complicated, multiple level problem in being able to regulate oneself and deal with impulses.
Yeah, I would agree. And the eating disorder that she had it has lasting effects physically and on like bone structure and so on, bone density. But I agree with Dan that some of the things that may have been behind the eating disorder are probably manifesting themselves in other ways.
So let me ask you an unreasonable question. What would you recommend for Susan?
She didn't really talk about whether she has ever been in therapy or been able to stay with therapy. She sounds like the kind of person who's maybe living a lifestyle that's very far from that. I would work through whatever trusting relationships she has to move in that direction.
And we know that, if it is, in her personality, if it's the architecture or even if it's an impulse disorder, it's going to take therapy, and it's going to take long-term therapy, and it's going to, if medication's involved, it's going to take tenacity. And this young woman has to make a decision to say, I'm going to work as hard as I can work, as long as I need to work to take care of myself. I wonder about contagion factors in eating disorders, Michael. Do they show up in clusters?
There are definitely contagion effects. So in other words, there's a lot of research showing that eating disorder behaviors tend to cluster in schoolgirls and in college students, for instance. And apparently it's because girls tend to make friends with other girls who have similar concerns and with whom they feel most comfortable.
Kindred spirits.
Yeah.
We've got about a minute left, Jane. What do we know about mindfulness-based psychotherapy?
We know that mindfulness is, I think, pretty core in the long-term effect of being able to resist using the food symptoms and the self-blaming, self-hating symptoms, because it's being able to know what's going on in one's thought process and be able to learn how to relate to that. Somebody who has an eating disorder never learned how to relate to their thought process. They learned how to distract away from their thought process because they didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, it's interesting, both what you're saying and the whole concept of mindfulness is related to cognitive therapies, because mindfulness helps you take a look at your mind and not be so reactive. It's kind of meta-analysis, which is exactly what cognitive therapy is. It helps you take a step back, take a look at your mind, and then cognitive therapy is simply, not simply, you assess, you know, what's logical, what's not logical, and come up with alternatives. But mindfulness, you know, it takes you down that very same path and gives you lifelong learning tools. Well, that seems like a nice note to end on. I want to thank you both so much for joining us, and to all the callers who didn't get a chance to come on. I am sorry we could have used a couple more hours. My guests today have been Drs. Jane Shore and Michael Lowe. Jane's co-editor of Effective Clinical Practice in the Treatment of Eating Disorders. Michael Lowe's professor of psychology at Drexel University, who researches eating disorders. The websites were nationaleatingdisorders.org, that's one word, achancetoheal.org, or nimh.nih.gov. Hey, join me tomorrow at noon on my Inquirer web chat, where we'll be talking more about eating disorders. That web address is phillynews.com/askdan. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about the issues that will be part of our two-part series on what's affecting boys and girls in our culture. We'll be talking about issues facing girls next week. If you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Our executive producer is Mike and Scott. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern par excellence is Jonathan Glick. I'm your host, Dan Gottlieb, and I want to leave you with a song about eating disorders composed by musician and psychotherapist Judy Freed. It's called Reflections, and it's part of her CD, Chipping Away.
Staring at the mirror, hating everything she sees, keeps getting clearer, all that she'll never be, and how she wants to be what she's supposed to be. And she's stepping on a piece of metal to see what she might weigh.